Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, hello, hello. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. My name is Alex Q, and welcome to the 8th episode of Miscast. Pete and Repeat were in a boat, and Pete fell out. Who was left?
Pete were in a boat and fell out.
Pete and Repeat were in a boat, and yeah. Pete fell out. Who was
so
left?
Repeat. Repeat.
Repeat.
Oh no, you're gonna say it again.
And repeat, we're in a boat.
We've sunk to a new low.
This is our 8th episode, where each episode, using the expertise of my superstar co-host and special guest, we will discuss tabletop topics that we hope will help improve your generalship, expertise, and enjoyment of your gaming experience. It's the podcast that will talk nonsense and sense, including the titles. And it's the podcast that's been enjoying video game accents after finding out that this podcast's own microphone can do sound modulating effects.
No.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Wonderful.
I've got a really random... I've been wanting to tell somebody this story for ages, but I've got a really random video game accent. Little ditty for you.
I'll go for it, because that was the first bit I was going to start talking about, so you go first.
So my neighbour, I live in quite a heavy sort of like Turkish community. My neighbour next door, Levent, he is a Turkish estate agent. He is the voice of Batman in the...
What?
Batman computer games.
What? What?
Yeah.
How did that even come out in conversation?
I don't know, but if anybody wants a signed copy, then, you know, go to a tournament with your Turkish version of, I don't know, Gotham or whatever it's called.
And I'll
get that signed by the man himself.
Owen, is he the chap that I tried to get in his car?
I don't know what that refers to, Darren. But
when I stayed at yours and Adam, someone was coming to pick us up, I tried to get in somewhere. It was your neighbour's car, and I believe it was a Turkish chap. I tried. I opened his door, and he was like, "Yes."
Did he sound like Batman?
Yeah. Was he wearing a mask? And did he have ears? And did he have a big swear to me? Did he say stuff like that?
It's not your vehicle.
Yeah. Exactly.
No.
Wow. So you're basically, you know, someone famous.
I do, yeah. Apart from you and Darren and Phil, obviously.
Obviously.
I know one other famous person, and it's Turkish Batman.
That is a story. That is not a story I was expecting.
No, I wasn't expecting to tell it either.
Oh, my video game accent stories are nothing like this one. Because just because it's been I was reviewing the year. You know, Happy New Year, everyone. By the way, I was reviewing the year. You know, everyone does like the year and what you've been doing, what video games you've been playing. And it was like Call of Duty and God of War, if you know what I'm talking about, if you're listening. And I just, as I was playing like Call of Duty, you know, have any of you played Call of Duty? Do you know what even I'm talking about?
Yeah, not for a long time, but yes. I was a World at War fan. That was my favorite one.
But they always have these like weird mission things where they can't say like the nation or the people you're fighting, because obviously they don't want to piss everyone off. So they can't be like, you're invading China or something. So they come up with these random ass, like make-believe countries that don't exist with random ass make-believe languages. And it's always some random Cockney soldier who's just standing there being like, oh, we got to go destroy the missiles from Brubba-lubba-lubba-stan. You come with me. Once we get to the top, you'll have to take out Araka Bashalala. And you're like, what are you talking about? It just got sent me in a spiral into video game accents. So yeah, that's why I thought I'd bring it out.
I don't have a video game accent, but I've got my favorite board game accent.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. I'm showing my age here, but do you remember the board game Atmosphere? Phil won't remember it.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so for people that are younger than 40. It was a board game you played, and you put a video in your VCR, and you'd have your telly on, and you'd play this video as you were playing. But it would be all quiet, and then like 15 minutes into the game, or you know, randomly throughout the game, like this figure would appear on the TV, and he would go, "Whose turn is it next?" And he would he'd scare the shit out of you. And I've done that impression like my entire childhood and adult life, because I absolutely love it.
It's one of those. It's like a Monty Python almost, the bridge dude.
Yeah, but wow, yeah, I loved Atmosphere. Does anyone remember that? What do you think of my impression like 20?
I don't know. I've never seen Atmosphere, Owen.
I mean, I've seen Darren do that impression before.
And have no fucking clue what he's talking about.
No, I know what Atmosphere was, but I wasn't as big an Atmosphere stan as others should be, obviously. But Darren commits, as with most things in life, Darren fully commits to that accent, and it's pretty, pretty damn glorious.
You don't do things by half, son. That's what my dad's always told me.
Oh, that's like did your dad do the voiceover for Call of Duty? Because that's exactly what the Call of Duty did.
That's so sounds like.
Phil, Atmosphere? No clue?
Atmosphere? No, not a clue. And I'm about as monotone as
I don't know what he's talking about either.
Accents aren't for me.
Well, you're on the wrong podcast, I'm afraid, for that one. Because in comes some Welsh accents to come up. I will do some. I might throw in some voice sound effects throughout the podcast just for shits and giggles.
Oh, so please do. Brilliant. We're evolving. Excellent.
We are evolving, exactly. Right. Enough of accents for now. Let's get some introductions going. So you've heard the sexy serenades already. He screams, he shouts football, he calls people perverts. He goes by @positivevictim on Twitter. It's Darren Watson. Hello, Darren.
Hello, lovely.
You all right?
I'm beaming. I'm beaming. I've had a lovely start to the year. Lovely Christmas.
Oh yeah.
We've got my good friend Big Phil on. I'm very, very pleased to be here. Yeah, absolutely beaming, brother.
And you were talking about your charity stuff just before we started recording.
I've been so I was last year on Twitter, if I made a typo, I would hashtag livid on it. And then I made the mistake of saying, right, every time I'm livid now until the end of the year, I'm gonna spend £10 and give it to charity. And I was livid, and it was in the hope that I would pay more attention to my tweets and making less typos. But in 6 months I made, to my count, 38. I was livid 38 times, but I got to the end of the year and it was a bit of a struggle financially because of the cost of living crisis. And I work in life insurance. Quick plug, if you need life insurance or critical illness or income protection, do come my way. You get a free impartial service, no pressure. It's been a bit difficult towards the end of the year because people are getting less mortgages and obviously, life insurance is sort of tied up to mortgages, etc. So I just didn't have 380 quid. But what I did have was, I've got a bit of time because I've got less life insurance work to do, etc. So I just put up on Twitter, I'll do £380 worth of one-to-ones to make up for it, to make sure that I do, do this commitment. And that works out at about 16 hours of my time. So I offered 16 one-to-one slots. I've actually ended up doing 23 because I don't like saying no to people. I've done 18 of them. I've got 5 to go. And we're on track to make about 500 quid, which I'm really, really pleased with. So thank you very much for everyone that's donated. It's really nice as well. People are donating to like dog charities and someone's donated to like the lifeboat chaps who do.
RLNI.
Yeah. I wasn't confident in what the letters were. So I didn't.
I just went with #levid. If I've got it wrong.
You got it wrong, by the way, Alex. Yeah, it's RNLI, not RNLI.
Oh, disaster. Nah. Oh, no, I'm going to have to do a charity thing then.
Exactly. Immediately donate £1,000 to the National... What is it? Royal National Lifeboat Institute.
Should be heroes. Bloody absolute loves, aren't they? So people have been donating to all sorts of charities. I even did one of the... international teams, so I had an entire team
it was
really fun. We delved into like team composition and what you should be doing sort of list wise and that sort of stuff.
Well, which you helped another team, Darren.
I'll help anyone. Like I think if we was it a rising tide lifts every ship, I think that's the way to get better. It's been loads of fun. So I've got 5 to do, I think, by my count. But I've been really busy.
No, that sounds good. That sounds awesome, though.
I'm really pleased.
Yeah, awesome. And your Christmas and New Year's was all right? All good otherwise?
Fantastic. So, yeah, Christmas was good. Because we're, we limit what we can eat. We're idiot vegans, let's say. People put themselves under too much pressure to try and appease us. And they often also get it wrong.
Eat some cabbage.
I'll give you some context. Like my mother's first Christmas present for me was some milk chocolate, and I was like, "Mum, thank you very much, but it's milk chocolate. It's got milk in it. I'm trying to avoid eating milk." And she was like, "Oh, it's okay, Darren." She sort of winked at me, and she thought Alex was out of shot. It's just chocolate. It'd be fine. I was like, "Okay, Mum, thank you very much." And then halfway through the year, I tried a different tact and just told her that I prefer dark chocolate to milk chocolate. I had to go with that. The next year, she bought me a bracelet made of leather.
and then the next year, she bought you a cow.
Close. The next year, she went, "I've nailed it this year, Darren." And she gave me some slippers and she was stroking them. She was going, "Oh, they're so soft." And they were made of sheep's wool. I just think she comes from a generation that just thinks it's a weird phase, Basically this year we were like, right, we're not going to go and impose on anyone because people find it stressful, and we're not this way to try and stress people out big as well. So on Boxing Day we had my favorite meal of the year, which is mashed potato, some cold meats, obviously we buy alternatives, and some beans. We have that every year. My son comes around and we go see my folks. But my mum again this year, my dad tasked her with the task of getting some oat milk for the mashed potato. Mm-hmm. And she came back with an oat drink, and when he went to put it in, it was a chocolate milk drink.
So you had, please tell me you had chocolate mashed potato.
We just pissed ourselves laughing, and like my mum went, "Well, I don't know." She's from the north, bless her.
There's the accent. Does it start already?
And then Boxing Day was actually our 10th anniversary.
Hooray!
We've been together 10 years, and I tried Viagra for the first time. And that was quite an adventure.
Nice.
We went. Got it.
It was uplifting, was it, Darren?
Yes, yeah, it was uplifting. Well, it was quite. I'm not sure how to rate it because we were warned by one of the Bruces gave it to us. I won't disclose who.
Oh, I bet I could guess.
Make sure that you use it correctly. You know, don't be too drunk, let's say. And Alex proceeded to get a little smashed on the meal that we sort of went to, and it was like we had a lovely time. I was very pleased. I probably managed 60% more pumps. So yeah, very Brilliant. Very pleased with that regard.
Brilliant.
Alex just sort of rolled over and then promptly fell asleep, and I was left like, oh my god, I'm quite stimulated. And then in the morning I woke up and I just had the worst, the absolute
headache.
Worst hanging headache. Yeah, it was really, really bad. So like, I'm not sure how to rate it. But some top tips if you are going to use Viagra, I would suggest don't get too drunk, you know, and make sure you've got plenty of energy so that you can, you know, work off what's about to happen. And don't start too late at night because you might fall asleep or your missus might fall asleep.
Brilliant.
There you
go. So there you go, listeners. You thought you were coming to listen to a War Game podcast, and actually, we rate Viagra. So if you've got any Viagra stories, actually, no, I'm not going to do that because I don't want your Viagra stories.
I'd say 6 out of 10 if I was to rate, but I'll give it another go and I'll let you know.
Well, if anyone wants to talk about Viagra, please do DM @positivevictim on Twitter and please do have a conversation with him and leave the miscast pod out of it. Right. After Viagra, should we get our other host in, Darren?
He is,
as always, the sexy socked seductor. You can find him at Sock on My Lolly on the gram. He's at OJ180 on Twitter. It's the Owen Jackson. Hi, Owen.
Hello. Hello, Alex. Hello.
How are you? Have you recovered from Darren's Viagra story?
Just about. I'll be honest with you. I tuned out of it because I've been chatting to somebody I'm trying to date.
And
her friends just figured out that I'm into Warhammer. And then I'm literally reading it to you now. She said, well, if he's got good diction and good spelling, it's either Dungeons & Dragons or Warhammer. And she's just messaging me saying, I'm hoping it's Warhammer. So I've just flexed on her with my current world ranking. And
oh, my God. Have you actually?
I heard if he's got good dicking.
Jesus Christ, Darren. Anyway, I better not. Right, okay. I've literally, there we go.
Are you a bit distracted, Owen?
I am a little bit distracted, but that's good. That's good.
You can give the listener your pillow talk instead, and then they can rate it. Listeners, if you like Owen's pillow talk, please send it to @OJ180 on Twitter. So he can.
Do you want to hear a bit of my pillow talk?
Please do. Please go for it.
Okay, so. Have you ever charged with Fulminators on twos and twos?
Please, please tell me you're going to use this line on the first date. Please.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but that made my bum wet.
Wow.
Munich is guaranteed with that, I'm sure.
I love the fact that you went down an octave as well.
Oh,
you
really?
Yeah, you went really soft. You went
down
soft,
an octave, I've got to say. I'm good. That I wasn't expecting to talk about that. But anyway, I've had 1/4 of a tin of Heineken. So, you know, all bets are off.
Oh, steady on.
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. I had a very restful festive season. Happy New Year to all the listeners, etc. So, yeah, I had a bit of winter sun. Come back all
the time. Oh, yeah, you buggered off to Morocco, didn't you?
Yes, I did. My brother lives in Portugal and he road tripped over with a friend. And so I had a Christmas on the coast in Morocco. And then I had a little road trip to Marrakesh. I love beautiful country and no Warhammer scene as of yet, though. Couldn't spot any gaming clubs or anything. So maybe that's my future. Maybe I'll retire and go and set up.
Oh, I'd love that.
Set
up a GT, something in the desert. I'm trying to think of something.
Cheap holidays for me, or have you had enough of me visiting you?
No, of course. So I was just trying to think of a witty title.
I'm trying to think of a witty title as well.
Yeah, like the Sahara GT or something. That's not witty, but that's just, you know, potential.
Desert's really hard to rhyme, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is great podcast material. But yeah, good.
No, but I had a nice Christmas. Didn't really do anything. Thought about some lists and stuff, but nothing that Warhammer-y. And then got back last week, and then went straight off to Brotherhood. which was fantastic. Had a wonderful time at Chris Tomlin's annual team tournament. Possibly the most competitive tournament I've been to in a long time, certainly since Worlds. And I think perhaps the most competitive Brotherhood so far, because you had lots of young up-and-coming teams and newer players. And then, oh, God, just so many of the names that you would expect to see, plus some sort of foreign mercenaries flew in. One, like the team that won Wargamer Online International, they were like the A-team. You know, they were like these mercenaries. So they had Philip from Russia, and they had Toby from the German team. They had Mac from the Swedish team, and then Luke and Andy. And who was the last person in that?
Chris
team?
Myhill.
Chris. Sorry, Chris. How could I forget? I could have Chris Myhill first, doing all sorts of naughty things with an incarnate in Beast of Chaos. Brotherhood was awesome. And I played with Team Lit, one of the new up and coming. I was like the dad of the team along with Luke. But we had an amazing time and managed to come fourth.
Yeah, I saw that. Really well done, because that was an absolute shark pit.
Yeah. Fourth and best, most sporting team as well, which shows that we did pretty well and we did it in the right way. So I would like to just take a second to shout out my team, which is Adam, Luke, Mark, Will and Quinn. Really, really proud of you all from the weekend. It was a great time and, nice to do it in the right way. Well, so that's me. Yeah, generally pretty good.
Job. Yeah. Good job. Excellent.
Looking forward to tonight and having a chat with you all. So,
As always. Right. Well, that's a very nice segue to introduce our special guest. So, he's played more AOS games than anyone else in the world combined ever. Since we started recording the podcast, he's already played three more. He's GW's best overall champion from the USA. And he's Team England member. You can find him at AOS_Marshy92 on Twitter. It's Phil Marshall. Hi, yes. Phil.
Hi, guys. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Woo-hoo. Thanks for coming along. Yeah, it's good. It's nice to have you on, especially since you literally have played more games than anyone else. So this is this is the best thing to talk to you about, because if you hadn't guessed from the title, we're talking about practice games, repetitions. So yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Did you see that he put in the chat, Alex, that he was annoyed that he's missed playing Techlist tonight for this?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Livid. Hashtag livid. Yeah, you're gonna have to do some more charity, Phil, if you keep doing that one. I said to you before we start recording, you set the twits on storm. I hope you've seen the all the replies you've had. People are desperate to ask you various questions. So yeah, it's absolutely fantastic having you on. I'm not going to make the same joke as always, because it's going to get boring to these guys. So instead, we're going to jump right into talking about practice and repetitions. Phil, practice. Loads and loads of questions. So I think to start off with, practice. Why should the listeners even practice at all for this game? Is it worth it? And a follow up to that will be how you go about doing it. But let's start with the why first. Why practice, and why do you practice?
I guess first of all, I'll clear a couple of things up. I don't have a time machine, and I am one person. So let's just get that out of the way to begin with. For me, practice is great for learning the game at whatever level that you're playing at, whether you're just getting into the hobby or you're a seasoned pro like Owen, Darren, other people on the England team, etc., and in the country. But fundamentally for me, it's learning the way that you enjoy playing the game and what benefits you the most. Mm-hmm. And then once you've worked out how your play style integrates within the game of Warhammer, it'll then enable you to get a better understanding of the types of lists you want to play, the types of armies that suit you, to really delve into all the possible avenues. And once you've worked that out, you then get all the reps in to work out how that army wants to play to suit your playstyle.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so for you, it's very much a kind of a deep dive into that faction, is it? Or is it more about a play style as a whole? Because there were lots of questions about practicing with one army versus practicing with lots of different armies, practicing one play style versus play styles. For you, is it kind of that kind of play style issue, or is it more just kind of getting to the nitty gritty of the kind of faction list that you're using?
I guess for me, to begin with, it was identifying my play style, so which quickly came about after attempting to take 60 Sentinels to my first ever tournament.
Nice.
trying to be the nice guy. And it really didn't suit me. I got quite bored with it.
Oh, really? Okay, interesting.
Yeah, just sitting there shooting people wasn't for me. So I thought, oh, Archeon got me back into the hobby. Let's see if he's any good. Turns out he was all right. I took him to one or two events.
Were the Sentinels before Archeon then, or did Archeon?
Was Sentinels.
That?
Yeah, it was 60 Sentinels in Hellon, living my best life.
Yeah.
So they're my first two ever tournaments in September 2021.
Gate, then, Phil, you tried to win. You went to do well. You weren't interested in fucking making friends. You went there to do as best as we can, or?
Yeah, like, I played cricket at the highest level you can in the country without being a professional. It's always the wanting to win opposed to doing anything to win. I just hate losing. So I can lose a club game, be livid. But,
I hate losing.
I was sorry, Phil. I was going to ask you about that with the cricket, because I played cricket as a kid. Me and my brother. My brother was better than me. And there's a lot of nets in cricket, isn't there? There's a lot of repetition in terms of, you know, you go to a cricket practice and you might play nets for 3 hours or something, 4 hours, or you'll stay in the nets beyond the session and just keep batting, or keep bowling. Do you think that has bled a little bit into your Warhammer in terms of
that's interesting?
You know, thinking about how, you know, I want to get better at this. I'm going to just get reps. I'm going to get, you know, learn the techniques of this army, learn the way this game works. Or am I conflating two very different things?
No, I think you're right on it, to be perfectly honest with you. Like, whenever I do something, I want to try and be the best that I can be at it. When I was playing the best standard of cricket, I'd net 4 or 5 times a week during the summer.
Mm.
Even now that I'm not playing the standard that I used to, it would be 3-4 times a week, as well as maybe 2 games a week.
Hang on, you're playing the cricket season. You're playing cricket and all these games are fucking Warhammer. Do you sleep?
No, I ruptured my calf last year. So cricket went on the back burner, and I've played even more games of Warhammer instead.
So what you're saying is the way to practice is to rupture your calf muscles is the way to practice more games of Sigma. Yeah,
exactly. It's how I got invited to Team Lit. Luckily, Rob, the Honest Wargamer, had to drop out, and I got put on this random army that I'd never used, which was Archeon and 6 Varangard for Brotherhood last year. It was a bit of a blessing and a curse, missing the cricket season, but then just probably playing another 200 games of Warhammer. So,
do you a follow-up question then? Sorry, Alex, I'm asking lots of questions here.
Please go ahead.
You're full of spunk this evening, aren't you, Owen?
I am indeed, every evening. Obviously, cricket being a seasonal game, was the intention with Warhammer, was that to like fill that gap between the end of the cricket season and the start of the next, like that kind of, what would that be, October to March, April kind of time? Was that to scratch your competitive itch, or was it just something that you wanted to get back into?
To be honest, it's probably going to be a little more wholesome than that, actually. It was,
we love wholesome.
Part of that, like I didn't really do a lot in the winter, and it was my brother got based in Catterick in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a conversation about just before COVID hit that should we get back into Warhammer? As something to do together so we could meet up around the country and see each other a bit more regularly. And we decided we'd do that. So I thought, you know what? Like I say, 60 Sentinels seems like the good way to make my brother happy. and it's been a bit of a competitive head banging against each other.
What did your brother take? Okay, what was your brother using? Is he like the nice?
Well, not particularly. He started off with Nurgle, and then he decided he was going to buy Merathi and the Bow Snakes.
Oh, I've heard enough.
Because it means he can't die on turn one. And it was a case of then just buying lists that beat the other person's list.
It's an arms race, isn't it?
And then, unfortunately for him, he doesn't get the reps in that he should do, because I think once he leaves the military, he'll be right up there as one of the best players in the country once he can practice more, because he just uses tournaments as practice at the moment, whereas I play nearly 7 games a week. So,
yeah. I mean, it is all jokes aside, it is absolutely astonishing the amount of games that you are managing to practice. And there's been loads and loads of questions like along the lines of, do you sleep? Where do you go? How do you fit all these in? Before we get to kind of how that kind of how you fit all of them in, you must love it and find it really useful, the practicing. You must find kind of these reps kind of really useful to kind of hold down. God, I can't even speak tonight. To kind of focus down on, as you mentioned, that kind of play style that you realize, oh, actually, I don't want sentinels. I don't want to shoot people off. And actually, now I just want to practice this style.
Yeah. So, the reps of like learning, like more recently, I've been more open to traveling a lot more to get good games in as well. So, like, I've played 194 games since July, which is 195 days.
Which is 60 more than you told us the last time. That was like the last 3 days.
So I think I've played like nearly 150 club games, and the rest are tournament games. So,
you're practicing. So all these practice games that you're doing, is this with one faction, one list, or is this multiple factions, multiple lists, but very similar play style?
So I also practice with lists that are massive greens against me. So I'll buy an army that I know my army isn't very good into, and I'll get reps in that army.
Oh, very interesting.
So I work out how that army likes to play, how that army wants to beat me, so that I know how I need to play in order to mitigate what that's trying to do to get the best out of it, so I can try and work out how I win these bad matchups. Yeah, as an example, dragons and long strikes were an issue for Archeon because they could shoot off your support heroes, they could shoot off your Varangard. And there wasn't a lot you could do about it. So I bought the army, and then I've never lost a Stormcast at an event since. So
wow.
I think that then comes down to, player skill probably plays a part, but also now I get to a table, you know it's a bad matchup, but you know what you need to do in order to mitigate the success that they can have against you.
Knowledge is power.
Yeah, I mean, so you set up, so say a normal practice day that you've got kind of ready, raring to go, and you've got your opponent, and you're going to, let's just say, Archeon for argument's sake. You're going to play, what, a game, two games with Archeon, and then do you flip, and your opponent uses the Archeon, and you use the green into it? Is that kind of how it plays out?
So that is really dependent on who I'm playing with. So it's easy to do with good players who can also, they understand how that army likes to work as well, but there's no point giving it to a friend that doesn't play the army because they inherently play it wrong, and you want to play it at the same level that you're expecting to play against it.
Yeah.
So I'll only do that with select individuals, whereas a normal club game, I love him to bits, my mate Rich. he takes an absolute pasting every week.
Shout out to Rich.
I can't believe you're still friends, to be honest.
he gets some pasting on Twitter as well, bless him.
He's getting better, though. He's getting better. He proves that you're only as good as the people you play. Like your original results were like, oh, yeah, struggled playing this bad matchup 32.
Yeah, exactly.
He's getting a bit closer now, isn't he?
But the thing is, like, for me, like, I'll happily play him 3-4 times a week, and I know for me it's about getting reps with my list and making sure I don't make any mistakes of mine. But hopefully, from his perspective, he learns a lot and he gets better, and you can see the progress he makes at events. But there's a lot of times where I've let him deploy and then I go, let me correct this for you, because you've played my list X amount of times and you know what it can do, and you've left me this huge gap into your 15 bow snakes. So before we get started, let's fix this. But I'll let him make the mistakes first, and then we'll talk about what he's done wrong, rather than just let him do it. I go in, table him, and then go, well, that's a line ticked off on my Excel spreadsheet, and let's have another go.
I was going to ask you about that, actually, in terms of, do you think that through the course of playing all these games, your desire for, like, the quality of the practice, the quality of the reps, has that, like, have you found that more and more you want to be tested, or, you know, are you re-racking a lot? Because, you know, people think, oh, reps, like, oh yeah, I'll play 50 games, and it may just be, you know, obviously most people on the pod here have played or gone to some form of international team, like, weekend, where if you play games against an opponent, it's not necessarily, right, let's play a 2,000-point game over the course of 3 hours and we play it all the way out. You get to the point where you realize that the game is overall, it's won. Rather, you don't know the points differential, but you fundamentally know. And then you re-rack, or you stop, you go back and you make a correction. Like, what form... God, this is a long question. What form do the reps take now, and has that changed?
So... Now I do get in a lot better reps, now that I've known more people in the community and people, like I say, being willing to travel to go and get good games in, which is something I'm definitely going to do more coming up this year. But it also is dependent on what stage I'm at with a list. If I'm trying to work out how the list wants to play, any rep is a good rep for me, because it's just for me, those reps. They're not for seeing how powerful the list is off the bat and wanting to go into, like, a Laurie, a Steve Follows, a Steve Curtis, etc. Mm-hmm. It's, let me fundamentally understand how the army that I've got wants to play to suit my play style. Mm. Once I've worked that out and I'm on autopilot with it, then I'm then looking to test it against the better players to go, right, this is the list, I'm really happy with it. Now let's put practice on off paper and put it into real life, and see how well it does what it does. But I'd like I say just willingness to get good reps. So, like, over Christmas I drove 600 miles in 2 days to play 10 games of Warhammer. So I went down to Dorset, played against the South Coast Eternals, got, I think it's 6 games in down there.
And again, all the home games, were they? Or, sorry, Darren.
No, so,
I was just going to say, he's leaving a trail of distraction all over the UK, aren't you, Phil?
Yeah, basically.
Were they all full games, Phil, or were they re-racks again?
So a lot of them, I think three or four of them in Dorset were decided by turn two, of which three of them were just, we call it there. And then the other three, Paul Buckler, we had a really close game with Ogres, which are quite frankly disgusting. he had no models left at the end of turn three, so that was a nice quick one. And then had a really grim game with Mike and his Hex Wraiths, which they're just disgusting in the old GHV, so I'm glad Bounty Hunters are going. And then Ricky with his slaves for practice for him at Brotherhood. But, I say, like, playing against good players, it's easier to re-rack, because other players like to play the game out. They don't quite understand that
They've lost. Like,
they play the hobby for a different reason, which is to roll their dice and have fun. So like
have a good time. Yeah, exactly.
So like last night we were at club and I played Rich. No surprises there. And I did 64 damage straight through into a 6-up ward with 20 wounds. And he was counting out all his dice. And I said, Rich, let's just hurry this up and pick them up. Because you're not going to make that many sixes. And he rolled his first batch of 20. And there were like 2 sixes. And he went to roll it again. I was like, Rich, come on. Let's speed up so we can get another game in. And whereas you do that with like Laurie.
Rich. I respect Rich because he wanted to show you something you'd never seen before. And if he hadn't rolled the dice, he wouldn't have had the opportunity.
No. But maths doesn't lie a lot of the time. Whereas
yeah, it fucking does. Have you played Blood Bowl?
Whereas me and Laurie quite often don't roll a lot of dice. So like something would go into something. We know based on maths what the output is and then just get picked up. Because that way you speed the game up a lot. It enables us to get maybe 3 games in 2-3 hours.
So you're kind of trying to hone into situational practice then, rather than like dealing with something going badly or something going well out of the odds. You're almost practicing how would this game normally play out if the dice kind of, you know, they'll go bad or good either way, but they'll even themselves out. And so you're sort of trying to aim towards those situational experience. Is that fair to say?
I'd say when you're at the high end, when you're playing other people that understand the game as well as you do, and also in those situations when you know a game is won, if, let's say, I win the priority, I know I win it, you then give it to your opponent and you see what happens if you didn't win it, if you're still in that stronger position. So it's a case of trying to really deep dive the whole scenario without actually investing all the time into it, because like I say, maths is such a good tool in this game, particularly when you're doing weight of averages. So if a unit of 10 chosen go into 9 untamed beasts, there's no point rolling any dice because I should do 7 mortal wounds to you before I even roll to wound. So
I like that as well, because you're less likely to end that game with a false narrative. So you know, you can play a game sometimes and there are anomalies, you know, just because it's improbable doesn't mean it's impossible. I know, because I've got like 25 years plus gaming experience. Like I've seen Rick Myhill roll 6 ones in a row and then roll another six ones. honestly, it's fucking incredible. But if that happened in one of your practice games and you use that to judge that game, then perhaps you end up with a false narrative. So I like the fact that you're taking the anomalies out of the situation, aren't you? So that you can actually, the data that you can pull from that game is reliable data. I actually really like that. That's a good, I hadn't considered that. That's something I can add to my practice games. Oh, yeah, that's nice, Phil. Lovely.
Well, go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say, like, particularly with now being in Team England, like the data set that I keep, I think will be really beneficial for when I start looking at the matrix for Worlds, because with getting these reps in and the data that I hold on it with no anomalies, and it should be, if everything goes right, this is how I usually do into this scenario against this army. This is the average kind of differential that we're looking at. I'm really hoping that I can use this to give myself a really informed opinion into the pairings matrix with whatever army I land on. I know I'll probably get in 100 games with it before Worlds. And like I say, that'd be 5 or 6 singles events, team events, and then God knows how many club games I'll get in. So,
You're speeding up those games as well, aren't you, by looking at the sort of by getting rid of the anomalies or not playing into them. So actually the quality of practice that you're getting increases, the data that you're getting increases, and your time efficiency increases. That's really cool. Yeah.
Related to that, does this mean that would you say the vast majority of your practice games don't make it to like a full tournament game would, if you see what I mean? Would you say the vast majority are kind of over and you just kind of call it, or you call certain things at some points?
So I'd say it's probably about 50% of my club games, because, like I say, some people at club, it's their one game a week and they want to play it all the way through.
Yeah.
And I could have that game three times a week with certain individuals who it's their one evening out and they want to play, and I'm fine with that. I'll let them roll all their dice, even if in my head I'm like, you're dead, but yeah, keep going. Then when I play with like Laurie, we can get three games in 3 hours, like easily, and both be content with the outcome of the game, because we know based on the game state after probably turn two, so turn three priority, what way the game's going to go. Particularly as I inherently play smash lists. So yeah. I'm trying to put as much pressure on my opponent early doors. And if everything goes my way, you shouldn't have a lot left. And then it's quite easy to kind of work out what's happened. So like yesterday, this is when I, again, telling people about how much damage. I think by the end of turn two, I took off 10 heart renders, 10 combat snakes, 15 bow snakes, and 6 wounds to Marathi.
Was that with all your lovely corn buffs?
That was with one lovely corn buff, yeah, the little my cheeky little bloodstoker. But
you're a little upset today, though, aren't you?
Rip.
It just means I have to 3d6 charge Varangard for a soul screen bridge instead. So I'm sure
context,
I'll be.
For context, the corn stuff has been removed from Save to Darkness, hasn't it? We just had a Battle Scribe update.
Yeah. Hashtag livid
today. Yeah.
I've got a few questions, if it's all right, Phil. This sort of feels like the Grill Phil episode.
The Grill Phil episode. That's what we call it.
I love grill food.
Let's Grill Phil. we'll get to the food topics later. Breakfast, etc. Hashtag pudding. I've got a couple of things. So, going to the idea of, like, you know, playing this many games to speed things up, and also, you know, for the other listeners, if they're like, oh God, you know, if I want to get in a couple of games, I've got one gaming night, maybe with a few different, like a slightly different approach, perhaps I could, you know, get as much quality practice in as you do, Phil. Like, do you, for example, when you play, you know, you've mentioned Laurie a couple of times, and I've played Laurie, are you like, lists in advance and choose a mission in advance, and then you get to the table and you know immediately what you're doing? Do you set your practice games up in that way?
Yeah, so particularly with Laurie, it is what's that, probably a couple of days beforehand,
mm-hmm.
list submission deadline, etc. Yeah. and then in the morning before, we'll roll out a mission, and then whoever gets a club first goes and sets it all up, sets the table up. If it's at Laurie's, there's usually not a lot of terrain when he's playing his lovely silver net, so you can't hide from him. And then when it's at club, I go and pick all the biggest pieces. But what we try and do more recently is it would be a really even board as well, so there's no benefit on either deployment really to your opponent to try and make the most balanced game as possible. Mm-hmm. Obviously if he's playing Sylvaneth and he loses the roll off and he sets up the terrain, then we allow a bit more space for him to place trees down, etc. But it's all kind of pre-worked out a good day or two before with lists, and then the missions again predetermined. So, as an example, if we're playing in the presence of idols, game one, game two would be head-on collision because we don't need to change the board at all.
Nice.
We just try and mitigate as much setting up as we need to, and just get on with the next one. And then it might even be like, let's just do battle lines drawn, because no objectives means for a nice quick game free. And Sylvaneth on hard mode for him is quite nice for me, where I don't have to worry about him striking and fading everywhere.
I'm getting a real theme from you, Phil, and also knowing, like, you know, you got a lot of success with slaves, you know, marketing. I'm getting a real, the word that just keeps coming to mind is efficiency. You seem
I'm thinking the exact same thing.
There's like, it seems like you're a very efficient person.
It's the accountant in me. I just don't see the point in why do anything. Is it what Steve Jobs said? Would you rather employ a smart person or a lazy person? And the lazy person will always find the way of doing it the quickest way. So I like to try and use my time as, like you say, efficiently as possible for what you're putting it to. So I'm trying to work out the quickest way of doing things. So like even this with list building, like I've got a spreadsheet where I have a list of armor saves, list of attacks, rend, and it's all formula driven. So I can just dump in the amount of attacks and I know the damage output for a certain unit. So then I have a rule of cool. So I only play with stuff that I like the look of. But if it doesn't do any damage, then I won't play with it. I'll just go and find the next bit of filth that I can get my hands on. But I just try and be good with my time, try and get as much in as possible, because time is king. I can appreciate I've been lucky and unlucky in the last 4 or 5 months where I've had quite a lot of time to play with because I've not been working. So I've been trying to utilise that to my advantage recently. Mm. But now I'm back to work and I've only managed to get 5 games in this week so far. I feel like I'm slacking.
you might have answered my next question actually already, which is like talking about those club games where, you know, you perhaps play that all the way through. Like, do you find there's any benefit in playing like with the handbrake on, as it were, or is there any benefit to like pushing shit uphill, as in, you know, taking something which isn't particularly good, but seeing what you can achieve with that army? Or do you always, you know, go with the very efficient armies, go with the armies that you know are good in the meta? How do you feel on sort of those 2 points?
I'd say, again, most of the time it's going to be dependent on stages. So, like recently over Christmas, I was pretty content with my Slaves of Darkness, and I think I could play it at an event with probably not getting many reps in with it and be comfortable with how I'm going to deploy against each army. So I ended up playing with my Fek quite a bit over Christmas because it's an army that I love. But it also enables me to probably play the game better because my army isn't as durable. Most recently, I've always played an army that is pretty durable and doesn't die. As most people love me playing Kotet, could attest to. Whereas Fek, you have to play the game a lot smarter, so it encourages better movement, mitigating more negatives in gameplay, especially when you're playing against Marathi and the Bow Snakes or an Alpha Striking Iron Jaws army. It teaches you the core mechanics and reminds you of what you need to do. Whereas getting my reps in with slaves at a point now where I'm on autopilot with it, it probably isn't as beneficial as now picking up a different army and relearning how that wants to play. So trying to like pick up what will probably be a top tier army, even though I've just sold all my Lumineth because I don't like the way it plays, but to play with it, understand how it's wanting to win, which is shoot me off the table in Technado. But get some reps in with that. But yeah, I don't ever go easy on people. And I don't think they'd want me to at club. I'm very fortunate to have the club that I have where they all want to play filthy lists and play against the best stuff to improve their own game. And I also don't think they learn anything by being spoon-fed, which may be harsh on people, but I know one day Rich will beat me, and I want him to know that he's earned it, and it's not been, and it's not just been gifted to him. I want him to know when he does beat me on that day, he's beaten me because he's played better than me.
Mm.
So I don't want to just be like, oh, I'm taking this really rubbish army, and you won. So I'd rather keep going on hard mode and try and teach them as much as possible whilst I'm playing as well.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. There's quite a few questions related to all the stuff. Is fascinating, is what I wanted to say. One thing I very quickly wanted to ask is, you mentioned that it's quite formulaic, if that's fair to say, that some of the practice games, and when you're in a tournament, obviously things always don't always go to maths and formula. Have you ever found yourself kind of out of your comfort zone when, I don't know, the dice have completely deserted you, or something's gone completely wrong, and because you're not practicing those situations, has that happened to you, and you felt, oh, hang on a second, I don't practice when it goes completely wrong? Or,
I mean,
sorry, go on. Yeah,
I was just gonna say, I mean, for the last 18 months I've re-rolled every dice ever, so it's really hard to have your dice go badly when you re-roll everything.
Right,
so that's the perks of my Slaves of Darkness, and now is going to be a hindrance to me, I guess, with losing them. But I think based on when the dice are down, I'm not really much of a stressful person anyway. So, like, I know I've done everything that I can do to, like I say, understand the miniature of the way I want to play, understand how my opponent wants to play. So when I get to a table, I know I'm not going to get surprised by anything. Most of the time, I'll know their army as kind of as well as I know my own. I'm not going to get caught out by anything.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you have to remember it's a dice game. So
yeah.
If dice don't go your way, you have to be prepared for that. I do like work out averages before I do things to make sure I'm happy with the probability if it comes off what I'm going to do, to try and mitigate the effects of, let's say, rolling below average or what have you. But it's also knowing what position you're going to put yourself into certain matchups. I know if I'm in a bad matchup, I'm probably not going to overextend because the risk of being doubled is going to hurt me. Whereas mm-hmm. if I know I'm in a great matchup, I can probably push a little harder. And if the dice don't go my way, I'm probably still going to be in a strong position.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just understanding when you need to push and when you don't need to push. And that's, I think, the benefit I've got out of playing so many games with like the same list. So like yeah. with Archeon, I probably got, I reckon I took him to 20 events last year.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't get anything worse than a 4-1 with him.
Yeah.
I'd deploy the same every way against the certain type of army I'm playing against. So if you were an alpha strike army, I'd have one deployment. If you couldn't alpha me, I'd have a different one. And then it would
and
be...
And that's all based from your practice games because you've experienced them already.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of, like I say, it's the mitigation of anything that's going to like panic you when you get to a table. So I know as soon as I get to a table, like I have this thing of, I always want to be the first player to the table as well. I want to get it all set up. Mm-hmm. I want to be in the zone. And then I know my opponent's army, but I'll still ask them all the questions.
Good.
To make sure they're not tricking me or leaving stuff out. And if they leave out the fact that they've got a teleport, I'll remind them. Mm-hmm. And then it lets them know that I know what their army does. And then I guess more recently, like having got into the England team and everything, I've kind of, especially with Darren, he's told me to strut more because apparently I'm kind a little bit of a big deal. But I never really
deal, brother.
I never really backed myself a whole lot in the first season where I was playing, because I always kind of felt like I had something to prove. Mm. Whereas now, I kind of...
Brother, I'll just expand on that. You're in the fucking England team, mate, and you got there within like 12 months. Like, if that isn't cause to strut, fuck me. There's like 0.01% of the player base is ever going to be able to do that. Be fucking proud, mate. Well done.
I know. Yeah, exactly. I'm over the moon with it. Never did I expect it. And like I said, I've had a great year, well, 18 months now, where I've been very successful on the table, and I've made a lot of people that I'd consider great friends from it, which is above and beyond what I could have expected. So yeah. No, it's been good.
Yeah, awesome. Wow. I mean, that, as I said, I'm just fascinated. And I think listeners really enjoy listening to what exactly you get out of all of these. There's absolutely tons of questions. So I think we might give you a bit of a breather, Phil, because we've just been literally grilling you to crazy. Darren, practice. So for those, there's lots and lots of questions sent in by listeners about various bits of practice, which Phil has admirably answered already. Lots of questions around what if you can't do this? So obviously Phil's mentioned he's been unlucky and lucky with the ability to kind of practice lots of games, but there are people who either don't have the inclination or don't have the time, have got busy lives, children, jobs, etc., etc. What's the sort of way, if you can't do what Phil's doing, where you can get in that kind of efficient practice without doing or being able to do as many reps?
Yeah, now, well, I can cover this because I very rarely practice. Quite often, my first game with a list will be game one at an event. But what I have done, like leading up to that event, is fucking use my imagination. So I've probably played as many games as Phil, if not more, in my mind prison.
It's the chess. What's the name of the chess series? Queen's Gambit. Where she plays the chess games on the ceiling.
Yes, but just without the drugs.
Less drugs, more Warhammer models on the ceiling, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. No, so I just, I think, so I'm not mechanically very good at Warhammer. I said this loads of times, but it's the truth. Like, there are other gamers out there, like Jack Armstrong, for example, that I've played 6 times, but I've beaten him 3 times. But he's better than me on the table. But I think where I can compete and where other people can improve if they don't get to play a lot of games like Phil or Jack, etc., is I'm really fucking prepared. I put a lot of thought into my list design. I put a lot of thought into how my list design how it relates to the meta. I put a lot of thought in how my list relates to the missions. So I'm complete opposite to Phil. You know, I'm not very formulaic. You know, all sorts can try and I'd sort of break the people that are the formula players, let's say.
You move into the chaos, is how I describe you.
Well, basically, formulaic players, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a really great and successful approach. It's just not something that I'm capable of doing because I don't have the attention span for it.
Yeah, sure.
I really didn't know what that was for a second then.
But the formulaic players, what they do present is a problem, but you know that problem. Okay, so I can obsess about how to defeat dragons when they came out. I obsessed about how to defeat, you know, the 6 Magmadroths when they came out, etc. And I find that 9 times out of 10, and I also speak to these players, how they're using them. So I get a lot of insight from the conversations that I have with people, you know, what they're going to be doing. So if I already know the problem they present, then I can have a real good think about how I'm going to go about breaking it. And you've got to do that in your head, unfortunately. But there is plenty of time to do this. You can be thinking when you're washing up. You can be thinking when you're having a swim. You can be thinking when your girlfriend makes you watch another terrible rom-com. Although I would suggest you don't always do that, because it is really important to be present within your relationship. So I'd say about 1 in 3 rom-coms I let my mind wander, and the rest I make sure that when Alex asks me loads of enthusiastic questions, I can give her genuine answers. but you know, if I'm out walking with a dog, you know, or, you know, there's this, we say we don't have time, but actually, in fact, we've got a lot of sort of time where we're doing tasks that we would rather we're not, or we have to do, you know, we can do on autopilot. You know, I can walk my dog around the park on autopilot. And then I can use that time to have a real good think about Warhammer. I don't always do that. Again, Freddie gets plenty of attention with the ball, etc. You know, I'm not a complete arsehole. But my favourite time to think about Warhammer is in the swimming pool. You know, I love the fact that you just go, you get a nice pace, you know, with your breaststroke, and then your mind completely wanders. And what I love about this mind wandering is you think about all sorts of crazy situations, and sometimes when you let your mind sort of wander, you find absolute gold. That's how I found my Seraphon list that I took to Worlds, which was obviously three Snake Basties and Croak. Like, I think it's fair to say that was pretty different to anyone else that was running Seraphon before. You know, and that was like a good sort of swim session. And then you can just, yeah, you've just got to really, really, you've got to really, really, really use your imagination. And it's the same, it's luckily it operates the same, it's the same skill set that when you're thinking about deployment and you're thinking about your opening moves, you know, again, if you're not doing this, you absolutely should be. You need to get to the table, like Phil says, with a sense of control. And you get that from having a good plan, what you're going to do, and knowing what your first opening move is going to be in various situations. And if you can't do that at the table, and you can't get that experience and that knowledge from reps, then you can absolutely imagine it. If you don't have a very good imagination, I promise you, start using your imagination and you get better at it. You know, you could stop watching porn, for example, you know, and then start imagining other things.
Yeah, heresy. Yeah.
But yeah, I would suggest start using your imagination. Absolutely. It's possible. It's absolutely possible to do.
And would you think it's fair to say that the two approaches sort of lead to the same outcome? But for Phil, he's experienced that same situation. He knows how these things go. Seen it, done it already, and therefore knows what's going to happen. But for you, because you're imagining the situation and you're kind of thinking of the overall game plans, you're coming at it as a much more kind of overall how lists or factions like this play rather than the actual minutiae. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that is fair to say. I mean, I don't really understand your question because I was too busy having a good old giggle.
Me too. Hey, Alex, or whatever you are, can you just say matrices, please?
Matrices.
Fucking hell.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Just to jump in, I think I would say... sorry, Darren, did you actually understand the question?
No, not at all. Carry on, my love.
Basically, I would say that I'm in between the two. I'm halfway between the Phil approach and the your approach, Dazza. I think I've not been in the game anywhere near the amount of time as you, Darren.
And
I've only been in the game a little bit longer than yourself, Phil. But I think, basically, I think I was... a little bit like maybe Phil 1.0, and he's taken it to like the nth degree, whereas I put in a lot of games and a lot of reps early, and then I found that I've slowed down and I've lent more into essentially I only really play tournaments now apart from the odd game. I don't know if maybe that's a bit of arrogance. I'd have to check myself on that perhaps. But also there's an element of that I've been playing the same list now, much like you've mentioned, Phil, in terms of, you know, I can turn up with my Reign of Stars list now. And whilst I've looked to make changes over the course of several tournaments, I can't beat that list in my mind for what it wants to do. So I do feel like I've played a lot of the matchups and I understand the win condition. I understand the pivot points in the game. But I'm leaning into a lot of that accrued knowledge, even from like GHB to GHB. Obviously, the missions change, but you would attest to this, Darren, and I'm sure yourself, Alex, as a long-time gamer. Like, the path to victory in a war game the way in which you deploy your army and the shape of your army and understanding how to win. I'm sure that hasn't changed over multiple years and multiple.
They're transferable skills, aren't they? Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, from fantasy to Age of Sigmar, you know, whilst a lot has changed, you're still putting troops on the board and looking to then kill your opponent in myriads of different ways. And obviously with objective play, then you know how you want to, you know, I call it the rhythm of the game. I don't know if that's quite the right term, maybe the tempo. Like, you know, in a game when you've played for a certain amount of time, you know, oh, like I've lost or I've won, or this is tight, or I'm going to need till turn five, or I need to push here, or I'm fine, I can give the turn away. Like, you understand the game state much better. And I don't know if that's necessarily list specific. That's just a bit of a feel.
I don't think it is, Owen. I think sorry to jump in.
It's a conversation.
Age of Sigmar comes down to, when you really boil it down to, and it's the same as 40K, Necromunda, Blood Bowl, all these wonderful, beautiful games, chess, you know, Sudoku, like all sorts. It comes down to problem solving, mm-hmm. You know, and you can, if you've got a limited amount of practice, then you can just make sure that you're practicing problem solving in your sort of everyday life. Let's say, so you can be formulaic or you know, because you're really drilling it into yourself, and that's really good because it gets you to the table and you're super confident in yourself, and you put down and you present your problem to the world, don't you? That's what reps can do. When Phil's mentioned a couple of times, he's on autopilot, but if you can't get to that zen state, then you need to be the person that is breaking those questions. And if you haven't been put in that situation, you know, too often, you have to make sure that you're really good at problem solving on the fly, problem solving on the spot. That makes sense. And the only way to do that is to make sure that you are practicing problem solving, and not just, there's no point someone like me or you, Owen, let's say, that hasn't got the time or the drive or the desire to practice outside of tournaments, let's say, practicing like Phil, because we would need the time and the reps to get to that state.
Yeah.
So we need to be, well, I would say more so me than, let's say, because you're like a hybrid, aren't you, Owen? But I've got to focus my time and my effort in making sure that my on the spot, on the fly problem solving is pucker.
You think, going back to one of the earlier questions then that was posed by Alex, you know, obviously this is a question for everybody. Do you think that if you have limited game time, you should really stick to an army, really stick to the core of a list, so that the practice isn't quite as scattergun and you're limiting the variables, so you're actually getting some good learnings from the one game a week that you get to have?
I think yes and no. It depends on your, like, so going back to an earlier point, I'm an old fucker and I've been playing these games for over 25 years. So someone that's new into the hobby, probably yes, I would agree with that. But for me, if my practice time, I'm quite happy making sure that when I put any old shit on the table, and I'm really concerned with practicing problem solving. I want to be put in as many unique situations as possible, and I want to be able to get to the answer or learn to get to the answer on the table within the time that I've got. So when I go to a tournament and a unique situation pops up, I don't panic, and I've been in that situation in my practice time, because I feel very confident that I can understand the problems that Slaves to Darkness pose, that Dragons pose, and I can do that in my mind. You know, I can solve that pretty well in my mind, and I know I can because I've done that for years. So my practice time is actually, if I do the limited practice time that I do get, I'm trying to practice all sorts of as many situations as possible so that I can keep myself stress-free when a unique situation pops up. Because I'm pretty confident that I've got the vast majority of the meta-relevant problems already solved in my head from my mind prism.
Yeah, you're both. Am I back off demon now? It's all good.
Yeah, that was genuinely terrifying.
I'd just say, in response to your question, Owen, about sticking with an army, I think it probably is dependent on the level in which you play the game as well. So if you're like Darren, who's got 20 years experience of playing...
Oh, thank you. It's 25, but 20, that's okay. Lovely.
I was going to say 20 at playing at the highest level. And then if you're quite new or you're like... and you don't get enough time, then you are probably better off sticking with the army that you can get your limited time in and really learn how that army wants to play, rather than chopping and changing every event.
And alongside that, Phil, lots of the questions that came in from listeners was around, you're picking that list to kind of get to know it. Should people in that situation, should they net list? Because they know that, you know, other players have practiced and had the game time to use that list, and therefore lots of these lists are very strong because they've been practiced lots by other people. And therefore, should people kind of use things that they know are strong because they've got limited time, or should they just get fewer reps in with something that might not be as good, but they know they can practice it a bit more?
A bit of both. I think if you're going to net list, make sure it's a list or an army that you already have a fundamental understanding of. Again, particularly if you're not playing at the highest level for like a prolonged period of time, I would say picking up an army that you've seen consistently will go 4-1, 5-0, or 3-2 even, depending on what you're looking to get out of the game, is beneficial, particularly if you can't get all the reps in, because you know the hard work has already been done to get the list tried and tested for what you want to get out of it. And then it's always nice to be the person that first comes up with a list, right? So if you can, like Reign of Stars, it's pretty unique, and now you see them kind of sporadically in places and you're like, oh, I know the guy that came up with this, or Darren with his snake basties that everyone thought he was mad for. And then, yeah, because like no one's seen Slaves of Darkness yet, it would be a case of who's taking what at LVO particularly, and see what happens.
Hey, guess what, Phil? At the weekend, somebody said to me, oh yeah, don't worry, you're playing against one of Phil's lists. So I did play against one of your lists supposedly the weekend. Sorry to butt in, but a quick one on lists. Like, are you a list writer? Do you find that a proportion of those reps are honing a list, or going to the point that Alex says around net listing? Do you know, you've obviously got a lot of friends in the community, and obviously, you know, I understand that I'm not an S tier list writer. I tend to get the core and then I ask some friends to finesse it. How much of your reps are, you know, honing a list, or do you step in with a net list of sorts? Like,
I mean, I guess the Slaves of Darkness list that I played last year, like I picked up Archeon after he got taken out of Tzeentch where he was stupid. And you had everyone running 30 Marauders, and I hate the models, so I'll never play with them because I refuse to paint them. So I was like, well, what equals 30 Marauders? 3 more Vanguard. So I was like, cool, I'll do that. Put some changes in, grab some Iron Golems instead of extra other bits. And then I think it's probably pretty fair to say I got probably known as like the Archeon guy, and then my Archeon list that I ended up playing with became the one that basically everyone played with. Whereas Kotet, which I ended up taking to Six Nations and playing at the last few events in the build-up, was a net list. Like, it came from Toby playing it at Worlds, whether that was other people creating it in the England team and then kind of jumping in off the back of that. But I didn't jump on that, even though we knew it was probably the best Slaves of Darkness list, because I still was a fanboy for Archeon. It was only when I really needed to test it at tournaments to make sure I was prepared properly to play it for England that I took it. And then it was a case of making subtle changes. Like, I really liked the Mind Stealer in it over an extra unit of Iron Golems because of how important Roars are. and now it's not a monster. I'll probably never use the model again. So,
yeah. And how many games do you? How many practice games do you do before you start making those changes? Is it easy as you play one game and you go, oh, bloody hell, that was crap. That's out and that's new. Or is it much more you give stuff a chance and then change it after, say, 5 or 6?
So I think the best example I can give you with actual analysis would be with the new Slaves of Darkness book, I've played 70 games.
Mm-hmm. It's not even out yet.
When I first looked through the book and when I did the review show with AOS Coach, I was kind of all about Host of the Ever Chosen and thinking, right, double banner, really strong, Chosen a battle line, Varangard a battle line. I'm going to really hone in on this. Then it was after about 10 games I realised how important the magic phase is to really elevate Slaves of Darkness to the level that I want it to play at and get the consistency with. That led me to then playing Cabalists, which I've played 50 games with so far. And I've kind of really honed in on learning the minutiae of the way that wants to play, the intricacies of what marks to give certain things. So like making sure your wizards are zinch so that you can cast a teleport spell so they can move 9 inches further forward in the hero phase to catch up with the rest of your units to add buffs on. Because I was running them as Slaanesh, so they could get an extra run to their run. I was like, well, if I can teleport them 9, then my effective range on demonic power is 27 inches instead of 18. So that unit that I've already put down the board to deal with my opponent, there's a chance I can probably get the buff on them again in the next hero phase.
So it's much more games before you make a change then. That sounds like quite a few, because I know we joke about saying you had 10 games, but that is a lot for some people. And so it sounds
can
like
I,
it's quite
can
a
I
lot.
Can I say something on the subject, Alex?
Of course.
This is a question that comes up a lot with my patrons. Try not to be results orientated. So if you lose a game, don't think to yourself, oh, I'm going to change this, that, and the other. The point in which I advise people to start making tweaks is when you understand the list and you understand why you lost or why you need to change. You know, so look less at the result and more at the why.
Performance.
Exactly. Because again, being results orientated, you could play a terrible player and get a win. You're creating a false narrative. You could play a really good player and get a loss. You know, and again, that can, you know, be wary of false narratives. But the time to make changes is when you actually understand what you've got in front of you. And once you understand that, then that's the time. Because if you don't understand that, you're not going to fucking understand what comes in.
No, yeah. 100%. And like with regards to making that change from Host to Cabalist after 10 games, I hadn't lost a game with Host of the Ever Chosen. So it wasn't a case of, oh, I've lost a few games. This isn't working. It was realizing how important spellcasting was.
And once
I knew that, it was, how do I get that more consistent? And it's, well, I can cast 5 spells hero phase on 3d6. So it then puts you into a better matchup against lists that should be tricky for you, like Zinch, who could unbind your spells. Obviously, Teclis has got his auto unbind, but you then still have 4 more spells on 3d6. So it's trying to mitigate what's going to be a negative play experience for you into what are going to be tough matchups, and then seeing what's within your book to benefit you in that instance. So the ability to cast on 3d6 with all your spells, which you need in Slaves of Darkness at the moment to get them to play at a competitive level, just made the most sense. And it also meant I could take out my Chosen from being battle line, so they couldn't get bounty hunted either. So it was just mitigating more damage, realizing you probably didn't need the additional banner, particularly with RIP the Bloodstoker. Whereas now there's again certain things that needed to have changed, and fortunately I've played, like I said, I think 70 games or whatever with the new book. I kind of expected the nerf to come, So it was a case of what can I replace? And I'd worked out my new list within probably an hour, done the maths on what weapons I'm equipping my Varangard with. And it's quite an easy change to get in. Kind of does the same thing, just as reliable through a bridge.
Mm. Interesting. It's really interesting. Yeah. You've preempted one of my questions, which was, do you feel like all those reps that you've got in, I mean, I think you are benefited by the fact that that Slaves to Darkness book is such an excellent book and it does have ways to pivot. But yeah, you've kind of preempted a question in terms of, do you feel like getting all those games in gives you a really fantastic, like, foundational understanding of the book and how it likes to play and what the important elements are? And then hence, when the Bloodstoker nerf came today, you were equipped to be able to know how to pivot and still make it work. Like, do you feel like the reps always are put you in that position then?
Oh, massively. Like, just to have the understanding of the whole book, like, and knowing each unit that I want to play with based on the way that I want to play the game. I've never really played with squishy stuff, so I've always played with the big tanky unit. So I know I'm going to be running Knights, I'm going to be running Chosen, I'm going to be running Varangard. What lists can I build around them? What marks do I put on? So I was toying with, do I make my Chosen Slaanesh? Because then I've got an 83% success rate for a Soul Screen Bridge with a reroll. So it's not as good as the Bloodstoker with the +4, but at least I'm +2, so it's a 7-inch charge. Or do I then go down the Varangard route, drop the Bloodstoker, drop a unit of Chosen, and get the 3d6 charge, which, again, is incredibly successful for a bridge. So it was a case of, like you say, knowing the options that I have and knowing the way I want to play, which enables me to pivot quite easily into list building for my army. So yeah, I'd say it's a massive benefit for playing the 70 games of Slaves and all the lists being fairly similar. And also, I guess we all knew once Blades of Khorne came out anyway, the likelihood is the allies would disappear. So I've got reps in without Bloodstokers to try and see what other things I could put in. And if I'm running Sigvald with a War Shrine, for example, which I think has a little bit of spice about him. But
beautiful.
It's, yeah, just understanding what subtle changes you can make that don't really change the list. So like, I've lost a Bloodstoker, but fundamentally the way my list wants to play hasn't changed, and the way I will take it to a table hasn't either. So I'll find out tomorrow when I go up against Hellon Teclis with my games that I've got planned, to see if it does what I want to do.
And you're still very much honing into that play style. I mean, Darren's talked a lot about this before on this podcast, about kind of knowing who you are as a person, having insight into how you want to play. And it sounds very much like you had that experience with the Sentinels and you were saying, right, that isn't me. That's not how I'm going to do anything. And now you've practiced so much that play style that you can sort of plug and play, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I knew I didn't really like the sit castle approach, whereas my play style, for those that have played me, have probably worked out that I like to play really aggressive, and I'll go for like big dick plays over the safe one most of the time. So I want to try and put as much pressure on my opponent as possible to force them into more decision making, where I then have to do less. Mm. So if my opponent's having to think about the game more than I am, I know I've got them where I want them. And every army that I've played since, that's been the approach I've taken. Even with Kotet in the last edition, it was more of a castle Slaves of Darkness army, but I'd be looking to Mask of Darkness my general down the table turn one and look to pin their whole army in and just win on the primary. So I'd go for the more like out there plays with a list that would inherently just sit there and wait for its opportunity. And then obviously Archeon doesn't allow you to play Warhammer properly, because he could look into the future every turn. so you'd know if you were getting doubled or if you were doubling them, which really, really honed in on like my play style with how aggressive you can play, because it tees you up for it. Like, you know when to push, which has really helped me with working out how I want to play the game. Whereas, like, I took Seraphon to Blackout. I think I've said it to everyone. It was like my first 5-0, and it was the worst weekend of my life.
like, interesting.
It just didn't. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy the way it played because it sat there, and it should've just. I should have done. That's what I've got. I've got like 96 skinks waiting to be built for the new book. but it's a case of, like I say, work out what you want to play. Like, I summoned 210 Saurus over 5 games with an Engine of the Gods, so my England dice are really good. great oven.
But you just didn't enjoy it. You didn't even despite all this efficiency in your practicing and kind of enjoying that practice, you got the 5-0. But actually, for you, that wasn't the be all and end all. Actually, it was how you got there.
What an ungrateful bastard gets his 5-0 and didn't enjoy it.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? Whereas, like, getting, which I think is the last 5-0 with the old Slaves of Darkness book, meant so much more for me, because that was the army that I played with for 18 months. So to get that 5-0 with them was amazing.
That is incredible.
And like, even to take it to New Mexico, Slaves of Darkness, and me and Darren being the, in inverted commas, bottom seeded people ready to shake it all up. I took it over there, and they had no idea what my army did. And I played the semi-final and I won 26-2 in Realmstone Cash, which was quite good fun. But
question, Phil. I might know the answer to this because I'm in the same boat with my boy Nagash. But did you have a 5-0 with Archeon?
I never did. No, only in teams, which I say doesn't count because you get put into good scenarios. And favourable matchups, even if I did have to play Dragons twice. But it was never 5-0 with him, but got, I think it was 23 4-1s in a row.
Yeah, I hear you, man. With my
I've got a 5-0 for you, Phil, with Archeon. Don't worry about it. I've got you.
Flex!
but then, like, this year, I think I'm 28-3 with Slaves to Darkness.
We had a math off. Well done. That's a much more eloquent way of putting it than I was going to say. Yes, between our two respective lists the other day, didn't we? Because getting our reps in, but yeah, we won't share those stats. But we're both going to LVO, hoping to do quite well, aren't we? But
indeed.
Question, Phil, you obviously fundamentally understand how you like to play the game and who you are as a war gamer. At what point in your reps journey, because I feel like, you know, you're basically the poster boy for practice makes perfect, I would say. So at what point did you, because obviously you dumped the Lumineth after a short time, you know, at what point do you think you because obviously you said you got Archeon because you loved the model and that's what got you back in. You know, that play style around him and the Varangard, you know, at what point did you feel like, oh, this is me, I'm home kind of thing?
Or when he started winning.
I think it was at what points of the game you got the most satisfaction out of or enjoyment. So, like, my favourite genre is fantasy. So when I think of fantasy, I don't think of people just shooting bows at each other. I think of big battles and in the middle, right up in the thick of it, as Simon Weekly always says to me, so we're going to have a big fight in the middle, are we? And I'm like, too right, that's why we're here.
That does sound very Simon, to be fair.
Yeah, and it was a case of, like, it might sound a bit cringe, is when I was playing with Archeon at club, just that sense of enjoyment of rolling dice in the combat phase and really immersing yourself into the hobby of, yeah, this is what I like. This is what I'm enjoying. I enjoy rolling all these dice in combat, moving down the table, putting the pressure on, rather than just sitting there and being reactive instead of proactive. So it was just working out like where I got the most enjoyment out of the game, and then really try to influence the army that I took to try and give me the most enjoyment, which led me to playing Archeon a couple of times.
Yeah, really interesting. So I'm going to ask a question that I want you all to answer, and I'm going to come to Phil last, just on purpose, to see the answers. And I think this is a fascinating question because I've talked about chess a lot on this podcast. And this question has come from a few people. And the question is, and if we start with you, Owen, is there such thing as too many practice games? And how do you know that you're not practicing down a blind alley, a dead end? And related to that, there's been lots of interviews with, and I've seen this myself, lots of top level, high level international chess players don't play any practice games before a big tournament. Because they're baseline knowledge. So I guess the question is, can practice be a bad thing? And I'll start with you, Owen. What do you think?
I don't think it can be a bad thing per se, but my only fear with too much practice is that I understand, much as Phil understands who he is as a gamer, and I'm sure both you and Darren do as well, like, I understand that I'm a sort of reactionary, off the cuff kind of problem solver. You know, I know how my army plays at this stage, and that's why I don't really practice the list anymore. And I think perhaps if you play a lot with the same list, and perhaps against similar practice partners, then the game can become very formulaic to the point where perhaps you're not appreciating the game state and the position of your army on the table, and because you feel like this is what I do turn one, and this is how I unpack turn two, and this is how I push on turn three. So I like to feed on that sort of bit of nervous excitement and stuff in tournaments, and much like boxers, you know, they don't spar or have sex for 2 weeks before tournaments, before fights. I'm not going to tell you the last time I had sex.
this is Owen's advocation, everyone, for your next Sigma tournament.
Definitely. Yeah. There's a correlation between me doing well at tournaments I'm not going to carry on with that thing. I would say that, you know, when things change and the edition changes and there's new missions, by all means, go in, you know, go hard, you know, get that knowledge base built up. But I do think that there might be something in the argument that there can be something that's too much practice. But I feel that Phil may have a more succinct answer.
Oh, well, that's why I've designed this question like this, you see. Darren, what do you think? Practice going down a blind alley without knowing lots of practice games, but it's actually leading you the wrong way. What do you think? Bad practice? Yeah.
Well, firstly, I think you can practice too much if you stop enjoying yourself. Like, if you just get fucking bored or something, then you can don't flog a dead horse. I think you can become a little obsessive, perhaps, like trying to make sure something works. Like, I really wanted to make Sylvaneth work really back in the day, and I never really got better than a 4-1 with it. Is 4-1 a flex? I guess so.
I mean, most people, you know, 4-1's pretty good for most people, I would argue. But yeah, go on. I know what you mean.
No, agreed. But my aspirations are goals with a 5-0. And I
fair enough.
I spent too long trying to get that because I wanted to be the guy that got the Sylvaneth 5-0. You know, kill your ego. Try and take your ego. What I like about some of the points that Phil was making earlier when he was talking about Laurie and how they can get three decent quality games done in 3 hours, you know, and they can be pleased with the result at the end of it. You know, And both of them fucking hate losing, I'd imagine.
Oh yeah.
They've taken their egos out of the equation though, you know, and that's got them to the point where they are. So you can have too much ego and you can really flog a dead horse. Yes, definitely stop when you're not enjoying yourself and stop if you've got to realize, you've got to understand your own limits as well. You know, you understand your own limits, I think.
And so for your point with the Sylvaneth, what led you to the realization? Was it just you tried it so often, or it just, you got to the point where you're like, oh, I just can't do this anymore?
It wasn't that I can't do this anymore. Oh, God, that is a good question. We're going back a couple of years and my memory is fading. But I definitely thought to myself, like, I can't do this. I'm not good enough to use Sylvaneth in the way that they need to be used. I need to find something that suits me a bit more. And what did I jump? I can't tell you what I jumped onto. But
no, sure.
I was more successful with that.
But it just hit a point where you was thinking, okay, this isn't working, and I just stop and move to something else.
Yeah, you've got to understand your limits, you know, and you've got to be like kind to yourself as well. Like there's this drive to get 5-0 and be really good with fucking things, but it's okay to not be brilliant at everything. It's okay to not be brilliant at being a reactive player. It's okay to not be brilliant at being a proactive player. You know, it's fucking okay to lose games.
yeah, absolutely. Right, Phil, what do you think? Yeah. From the man that practices a lot, bad practice down a dead end, realization, you might be doing some not so good practice. What do you think?
I think it probably is a bit of both. I think you can over practice. So, like I say, I probably play more than most people in the UK. And
I'd say the world, probably.
Yeah.
Most people put together, I'd say, Phil, yeah.
So it does get to a stage where I know, like, the outcome of a game before I'll even play, especially if I'm playing mates that are not as good as me, then it probably isn't good practice for me to keep taking my strongest list against them, because I already know how I want to play that list, so I'll end up taking something else. But however, it is good practice for them, because the only way you get better is by playing against better people and losing to people. So Laurie will love me for this. He's the person I've lost to the most this year, but he's also
bigger. Yeah,
I know. But do you know how many sports votes he's won as well? It's outrageous. But he's the one person at club that, if he's around, I always want to play, because the only way I'm going to get better is by continuously upping my game by playing people that are as good as me or better than me. So in terms of getting too many reps in with people that are better than you, I don't think that's ever an issue.
Yeah, you're only as good as the people you play. Fantastic.
So I would say if you can get loads of reps in with people that you look up to or you aspire to be or you try and be as good as, it will only benefit your game. However, if you keep smashing people with your top tier list and you're going, oh, here's my Slaves of Darkness list that I know you can't beat, let's have another game, then it's pointless. Whereas, yeah, I have been trying recently to really hone in on my LVO list, and it's all changed, so I've got to hone in on something else now. But I will try and chop and change things, and it won't be massive changes to my list to get decent reps in. It would be, let's try out the War Shrine and see if I can, what the Chosen with a 3d6 charge is like, etc., and make small tweaks that I'm testing different ways of the list out against people that aren't as good without really honing in on the importance of winning. It's more trying the odd variable whilst keeping most of the list the same. But
yeah, you're changing the quality of your practice depending on who you're facing.
Yeah, essentially. And like I said, I'm never going to give someone a freebie because I hate losing. It means absolutely nothing to them, particularly with my close friendship group that I've got into Age of Sigmar with me at the same time that I got into it. Like I said to you earlier, none of them have beaten me other than my brother. So when they do beat me, I want them to know that they earned it rather than giving them a win. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, that's awesome. All of these questions are, I've scrolled through some of the other questions people sent in. I think we've covered the vast majority of it. So I think the next bit, our next section of this was going to be our biggest mistakes, biggest tips. But I know we've been grilling you a lot, Phil, but it's been awesome. I mean, Darren, Owen, do you have any further questions before we get onto our biggest mistakes and tips? Or we've covered everything you'd like to know.
I've got one question, really, which is, obviously, the pace of change with the GHB is a 6-month cycle. So do you feel like the way that you, the amount of games that you play and the reps, is this the Phil template now? Is this set? Or do you feel like perhaps maybe I've started slowing down a bit prematurely? And I think Darren obviously has got 25 years experience, so he's built that knowledge base up. Do you feel like there's going to be a point at which you start slowing down, or do you just love it, so you just want to keep playing? Like, where's your head at?
I guess, like, I've been pretty vocal on Twitter about this with various tweets at the end of years and seasons, but I love the hobby, ultimately. It's been the best thing that I've done for myself in years, from a personal point of view, like the social side of it and the whole community, and getting that aspect in my life has been brilliant. However, I think the 6-monthly change in GHB is an absolute blessing for me, because of the amount of games that I play in a 6-monthly cycle anyway. It's quite nice to have change a bit more often. Otherwise, I could be looking at playing nearly 300 games in the same GHB and it probably be becoming a bit monotonous. Mm. Whereas now, like, the changes every 6 months will help keep it fresh. And I know only half the missions have changed, but it allows you to really focus on those missions instead of the ones that I've already played maybe 80 times in total. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the changes in GHB. I'd imagine, touch wood, I don't rupture my calf again. So during the summer, I'll probably have a little bit of time away from like real competitive AOS and play cricket for May till September, and then look to come back and smash face September to end of April. But we'll see. Like, I really enjoyed last summer with playing Warhammer, so I think I'll probably keep my toe dabbled in the competitive scene and maybe just try and do one event a month instead of two or three. So
yeah,
but time will tell.
Well, it's difficult letting go. It's difficult letting go.
The addiction is real. Yeah, exactly.
Ooh. Exactly. Well, I think in the first month of the season, I've already got to take two weekends out for Worlds and practice, so I'm not really helping myself, and then I'll probably be even more addicted after Worlds to
you're gonna have the best time, brother,
to step up even more, because I don't like plateauing, so we'll just see, keep the upward trend going hopefully, and that might mean more games if that's physically possible. But like I said, it'd be
I'm not sure it's possible, Phil, to play any more than you're playing at the moment.
Yeah.
Just to warn you, Phil, yeah, you can't get much higher than you are at the moment, mate. I mean, there's going to have to be some form of plateau. Or
I can be a world champion.
Yeah, with the announcement. Okay, nice. Perfect timing. Okay.
Well, I can be a world champion twice. I can do it with England and then perhaps in Atlanta.
And then maybe get the big 30-0 on the TSN rankings. That might be quite nice.
Yeah, I might have to pick up a piece of code.
I don't think you're helping, Owen.
Okay, fine.
I've got to chase down the fellow Team Lit member that is Freddie Leggett at the moment.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, that's balling. True.
So, it's all right. Team Lit have got the top four, so...
Well, that is fantastic, Phil. Thank you very much for all of those. And I hope all the listeners appreciate it. Well, I think we covered almost all of the amazing questions that were sent in. So this is our kind of biggest mistakes, top tips bit. I'll start with you, Owen, if you don't mind. Biggest mistake or top tip for people regarding practice and what you just advise people, I guess, for how to practice and what to do about practice?
I think it would probably be an amalgam of many of the points that have been raised through the course of it, really, just in terms of, like, you know, recognize, you know, a mistake may be just, you know, going to the club or having, you know, perhaps quite a limited group of mates and only playing against certain armies and always smashing. You know, I would say there's a sort of twofold mistake in terms of, like, don't just keep putting the same army on the table and losing, or don't just keep putting the same army on the table and winning against the same small group of people, because then you'll go to a tournament and, you know, you'll kind of get found out if you know, if winning at tournaments is what you want to do, which I think a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are quite sort of competitive focused. Yeah, that would probably be it for me. It's just, mm-hmm. Focus on the quality of your practice rather than it just be a box ticking exercise of getting in X amount of games. I mean, Phil's alluded to the fact that you can put in so many reps but also make them, you know, quality experiences. So yeah, look at the quality of your, you know, if you do smash someone off in the first turn, then, you know, stop, tweak the list and then re-rack, and, you know, don't just kind of play through 3 hours of, you know, just your opponent picking the models off.
Makes sense. Darren, biggest mistakes, top tips, anything you'd advise people to do to help them with their practice, etc.?
I think, so just maybe counter to what Owen said and Phil said sort of earlier, perhaps. I think it is important to practice when you're in a winning position to make sure you finish your opponent. So, like, I was going to say finish off then.
I can hear you going for it, yeah.
So, you know, don't be – it's good to, like, say, okay, I'm clearly going to win. Let's re-rack. But in actual fact, certainly if you're going for England, Phil, and other people that have got aspirations to get onto teams and do really well for your teams, like, you need to get every fucking point, right? So when you're in a winning position, make sure that you – sometimes that you make sure that you practice being in a winning position and that you end with the result that you wanted or an even better result than you thought you could possibly have. And also, when you're playing those games and you're in the worst position you possibly be, like, practice trying to get a point or 2 points, you know. Don't I would just caution finishing games too early all the time, basically. Yeah. I think that's a mistake personally.
No, I totally agree with you.
And then a top tip, try to think of reps. This is for the people that don't get as much time to actually play sort of Warhammer. Try to think of reps as not just on the table, but writing lists. You know, I will, when a new tone comes out, I will try to write as many lists as possible, and then I'll write their counter. You know, that for me is a rep, and that's going to give me some understanding of the tone that I've got no intention of ever playing. So you can rep that. You can rep your deployments. We've done episodes on list building and the importance of deployment, but get your reps in getting your models out physically on the table, get your reps in moving them into their first positions, get your reps in thinking about, you know, your route to victory. Make sure you've got a good plan for what battle tactics you're going to be using. And you can rep that because you can go, right, I'm going to be playing against dragons in this scenario. What's my river to victory? You know, what battle tactics can I use? Okay, now I'm going to put fucking hex race on the board and I'm going to see if there's any difference in what battle tactics I should be using, so that when you're at the table and you're presented by these problems, you can recognize situations quicker and you can already have a path to success, you know, thought about before. And that's really important because that's what my success has been. I'm one of the most prepared people at the tournament. You know, I think I'm not mechanically good at the game, but I'm very fucking prepared. Just try to think of reps in terms of not just, you know, physically playing someone, but you can get reps in anytime. You just use your fucking head. The more you think about something, then the better you'll be at thinking about something. You're practicing it. But also, the more you look, the more you see. That would be what I'd like. That's perfect. My biggest tip. The more you look, the more you see.
Yeah, perfect. Phil, top tip or biggest mistake you see with people doing regarding kind of practice?
I'd say the biggest mistake, particularly that I've made, is assuming when you are meeting new people to play, they have the same understanding as competitive that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So an example, I rocked up to Dice Saloon maybe last year and said, I'm looking for a competitive game. So for a tournament, and some guy said, yeah, I'm really keen. I've got a competitive list that I also want to play with. And he bought his KO, and I was like, okay, it's going to be interesting. I've not played against KO before, so I'll do my reading. Realised they could do all this massive amounts of rend, and I was like, oh, this could be quite dicey. And then I played him with my Archeon list, and I gave him the turn, and he put all his boats down the board, but not within range to shoot me. I doubled him, and I took it all off, and he was very negative on a social media platform about the play experience that he received.
Sorry.
So it was a case of, yeah, like I say, if predetermined what I meant by competitive and actually said, look, I've got a list that is capable of winning events and that's my intent to play it. What are you playing with? And also try and gauge their experience. It's something that I now do when I'm seeking local games with people outside of my play group. I won't be afraid to name drop that I play for England and my intent is I'm going to try and push your shit in, but I want a tough, tough game. So I'll pre-warn people and just say, look, this is the type of game I'm after. This is my experience with the army and what's yours. And I'm not afraid to say after their response if I'm not interested then, because I know it's not going to be beneficial for either of us. If I want just a normal game, then I can get that locally. If I want another super competitive game when other people aren't around, then I'll try and do that. And then I guess my top tip would be not to be scared to ask questions in practice games, particularly against people that you know are better than you, or you know you're into a bad matchup. Like, even if it's how would you deploy, what would you do with this priority? Like, what should my main targets be? Because that will also benefit you in practice as well, because you're then teaching them the way to beat you, which gives yourself the best practice in game as well. So my tip is don't be afraid to ask questions to your opponent, but you also have to ask those questions to people that you know would be honest with you, because even if you hate losing, you don't want to lie to your mates just so you can win. So
yeah. I like that a lot, just because if you can't get that lovely example where you said you're playing both sides of the coin, you can just ask your opponent if they're better and they can tell you the answer, and that might get similar results. Yeah, I like that a lot. Great. Right. As time is dragging on, we have our last section. So, Darren, do you want to...
I'm not doing it, Alex. You're doing it with one of your filters.
Yes!
Go.
Right. Here we go. Which one should I use? Let's use...
Oh, fucking wait. What was he going to use?
How about I use this one? Is that nice for you? The misplays!
Perfect.
That sounded like Darren's atmosphere voice, didn't it?
Whose turn is it next? What is your misplay?
Yeah, I should use that one. I haven't used that. That's Warcraft Gnome for any microphone aficionados out there. Warcraft Gnome was the sound effect. So, if you couldn't hear through my gnome accent, misplays. So, who wants to start us off?
I know Phil's got a massive one, so should we leave Phil to the end?
Let's leave Phil to the end. Shall I start?
Yeah, go for it.
Right, so I've got a lovely one. Well, we all know the ones I love. I love the I'm too excited misplays. They're my favourites. And you all have done it because all of you send in them and you're all sending your tooks. Everyone stop being so bloody excited. This is another I'm too excited from Francesco. So Team Italy Francesco, who sends in lots of messages to us. It's very and really nice messages about psychology as well. And he sends in this one. He was playing for Team Italy against Spain with his 27 dragon ogre beast lists, and he was playing against a dragon and long strike build. And he says he was playing in a three central objectives where one's worth more points. And his opponent had the decision who to go first, and he thought, right, he's going to shoot off my bits and I need to deploy like this. And his opponent gave him the first turn, unexpectedly. So Francesco stopped being so excited. He got too excited and just ran straight into the middle onto the objectives and thought, brilliant, I've won this game. I'm on all these objectives. You got no chance clearing me off all of these. And then it came around to the dragon and long strike build turn, and the dragon player moved all his dragons around to the herd stone and did a smash rubble on a 3+, and then cleared him off.
No.
So he went, oh, bugger. And so that is, I'm too excited. So thank you for that, Francesco. Yeah, I like the I'm too excited ones. So all of you just remember, don't get too overly excited. So yeah, thank you very much. Right, Darren.
I've got one of my own that I've been using as an example. And the reason I want to do it, or the reason that I've been using it as an example, is I want to drill it into my fucking head. It's not particularly fun or clever, but it's one that's plagued me. I played one of my Fight Night games, and I was using Cities of Sigma. And I was in melee with a unit of Outriders into some snakes, and I wanted to hold them in place so that another unit could come in and charge them, you know, and I could it's amazing how many times I say finish them off. So I could finish them off. And I thought to myself, right, I've got to do my sequencing correct. I'm going to do all my movement force first, and then I'm going to move my Outriders so that they can't redeploy. And of course, they've got like movement 12 Outriders or movement 10, something like that. So they can land outside of 9, but I only moved them 6. So of course, my opponent just redeployed, and I can no longer fucking charge them. It's such a stupid fucking error. So I have used this as an example with my all the one-to-ones and the charity one-to-ones I've done recently to drill it into my fucking head so I don't do it again. So just a really, really stupid misplay that's really pissed me off.
Well, hopefully that misplay, Darren, has helped other people not to make the same mistake. So
exactly.
Perfect.
That's the point.
Right, Owen.
I've just got one from the weekend at Brotherhood where even, you know, talking about reps, and yeah, I don't need to practice and all this jazz. You know, I still made a bit of a boo-boo, which was I played against lovely Byron from Facehammer.
Wonderful.
He's been pushing around 2 more crushers and a rogue idol in Iron Suns. So I kind of hadn't played orcs a great deal, but I knew that, you know, triple mighty destroyers, basically, if these boys wanted to move across the board, they could. So I set up what I thought was a really nice deployment. I set up that in case he gave me turn 1, I could auto 6 a unit of liberators up the board and then tag an objective, get 1-2 more, and then also be within 12 of all 3 of these big beasts to shut down the mighty destroyers.
Nice.
And then I had all my screens set up so there was 5.1 inches between the front of the screen and then the next unit. So if he smashed and bashed, the 2-inch range on the Maw Crushers couldn't touch any of my stuff that was behind, like my Fulminators or my Dragon or my Slam.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt really happy with my deployment. And then he took first turn and he duly Mighty Destroyers everybody forward, and he put, you know, he was putting his Maw Crusher forward and who was within 3 inches of my libs. And then he put his Rogue Idol up. And on my right flank, I had a unit of Liberators that were nicely spaced and my Fulminators were just behind. But just it triggered a redeploy and I thought I could be even cuter and basically make his other Maw Crusher with the aid of a piece of terrain have to go all the long way around my left flank and basically do nothing and be sat there ready to be smashed off by my Fulminators. I failed to remember that he had the Get 'em beat, which is a 6 charge. So the redeploy, which I thought was moving this diagonal line up to create a lovely sort of zone, bit of zone control, actually just opened up a perfect 6-inch gap. He then duly rolled the 3 up to get the 3d6 charge, rolled the 12-inch charge that he needed to jump the screen, and one banged off my Fulminators on the first turn.
Oh, wow. Savage.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was quite a big punish for what was initially what I thought to be quite a cute little move. So maybe I should have just stuck with my plan, but yeah, that was my misplay.
Lovely. Nice. Phil, misplay.
We're going to stick with the face hammer trend. I played Russ Veal at Bloodshed last year, 2022, and this is probably my 15th tournament with Archeon. Pretty comfortable with him. I've given Russ the turn. He's sent his Nurgle army down the table slowly towards me. And I'm like, okay, I know what I need to do here. So I look into the future. I've checked the dice. I'm quite happy with it, apparently. So I decide I'm going to push and I'm going to send everything down and going to try and take him off. And I failed a lot of charges, and I just managed to do my battle tactic. And I then looked in the cup again at the end of the turn to show Russ that I was doubling him. And I wasn't doubling him, and Russ was holding priority, which led to me losing 6 Baron Guard and most of my other units that can score objectives. And I had this sheer panic of, oh God, how do I now win this game? And luckily, Archeon did me a solid and won priority ever since and went through his whole army with a Chaos Lord. So that is my biggest misplay for someone that plays the game so much to not read a dice properly.
There's just beautiful imagery in that of you looking all, you must have been feeling really smug. Yeah, we're going to go to town. You open up the cup. Fuck, it's a 3.
Yeah, I was spitting feathers.
What I liked about that as well is Russ would have been like subconsciously picking up the fact that you were really super confident. So in his head, he must have been like, oh, fuck. Oh, I've got the 10.
Well, yeah, he was like, I thought you were doubling me. And I was like, so did I, Russ. And he was like, well, I guess I'll just try and kill everything then. I was like, yeah. Sure,
well, there you go, Phil. My top tip for you is to double check your cup and your dice when you do it in the future.
It's gone now, so it's fine.
Great, thank you very much. That's great. Right, I think that's us at the end of this podcast. So I think all that's left for me to say is thank you very much, Phil. Sorry if you felt like you were grilled a bit on this one, but it was fascinating to hear, and I hope the listeners have enjoyed listening to that. So thank you very much for coming on and
letting us know. Thank you very much for having me.
And enjoy the rest of your next 200 million games that you'll be practicing over the next few months. So, yeah, thanks. Thanks, Darren. Thanks, Owen, as always. For everyone else, do send your questions in to us. We love getting the questions. We love your piss takes and all the videos that get sent in. It's absolutely amazing. So do send us either through to Darren or Owen or to the Miscast Twitter feed, and we will get into answering them.
Can you sign off in a voice, please?
Yeah.
Come on, sign off in a voice.
But a sexy one. Is there a sexy one?
Is there a sexy one? Does Warcraft do sexy? I'll tell you what. I'll do... Oh, God. There's some real dark ones on here, so I'm not going to say that one. Let's just do this one.
So, thank you very much to everyone for listening. So, thanks again. Be kind. Look after each other. And... we'll catch you all next time. So cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, that was
all great. Done. Thanks.
We'll be right back.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.